Hey, it is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Sophisticated times, complicated times require sophisticated techniques. Okay, I'm here. I'm focused. I've got construction going on next door, all sorts of crazy stuff. So if the episode gets loud and knocky, that's not my fault, and I have no way of fixing it. I'm Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, stand-up comedian, escape professor, comedy writer from Late Night here in Hollywood. We're coming to you from Manhattan Beach, California, where I moved out of Austin, Texas a few months back. On the podcast, we do three things. Talk to comedians. I talk to the right because they need help, whether they think they do or not. And I talk to rhetoricians about all the things that are going on these days and how do we deal with them. And what I've been doing lately is sort of hunkering down with Dr. Dave Payne. And we're starting going into actual issues, like how does rhetoric work, not from just an abstract perspective, but when you start to apply it to real world issues. And it turns out there are constantly real world issues popping up. And the one that's popped up in the last week has been the Uvalde shooting, which brings us to the rhetoric of guns. And so we're going to try to break those things together today and see what happens. Rhetoric of guns, Dave Payne.
Hi, Dan. Yeah, it certainly is the discourse fabric in which we're currently wrapped, is the whole gun control controversy, which we seem to do after every one of these major events or more dramatic events. Wouldn't say everyone, because if you start looking at the numbers and they say, you know, we've had 600 shootings this year or whatever. Yeah, okay, I can only remember three or four, but.
Yeah, I went in.
So they must be happening.
I went and did a little research, like the deadliest mass shootings in history, in U.S. history. Just real quick, Vegas in 2017, 58 fatalities, almost 900 injured. The Orlando Pulse nightclub, 49 fatalities, another 60. Blacksburg, Virginia, Virginia Tech, 32. I mean, yeah, like you remember all those sort of big highlight ones. But when you actually start diving into, you know, shooting violence in America, it's like, whoa, hey, hold on here. 600 already, halfway through the year?
Well, I don't know whether exactly how that, where that figure comes, 600 per year since COVID or something like that. It jumped from somewhere around 400 to somewhere around 600 a year, I think, with COVID was the, and then they want to say, well, gee, look, COVID's to blame.
Right.
What about those the 400 base number there before COVID?
Yeah. So I mean, the question you start with is, what is the role of rhetoric in something like this? Like,
sure.
The idea of a heavy role, where, you know, when you actually look at rhetoric, should we be looking at this as something that we need to get in and help and do whatever work we can? Is it the light role where we're laying it out, trying to understand it, and then people can come and poach from the academic? What is the role of rhetoric here with
Well, that's a good question, and one that occurred to me in that, insofar as it is such an intractable issue, and people are so unpersuadable in their various sides, that even the, you know, totally shocking murder of 19 children, or somewhat, you know, 20 some in. Excuse me, Sandy Hook. It stirs one side, but it, you know, the denial blocks just go up on the other side. The same old kinds of blocks that we're hearing frequently. So the rhetoric does not seem to change because of the circumstances. So one might ask, gee, can rhetoric, you know, what rhetoric could go and analyze these different arguments? One's tempted just to jump in and start arguing. Right. But we will find it. So like abortion, it is one of these loggerhead issues that persuasion doesn't seem to be able to move people on. So that by itself, I think, is a rhetorical red flag.
Do you think that's because people are, you know, intractable, or the rhetoric is just not very sophisticated? I mean, or
well, it's, you know, is there something you could say that would actually change the other side's mind? And I think, once again, it isn't about argument. In this, it is like abortion. No particularly new phraseology or arguments or symbols are going to change people's minds about this. And that means that we need to look in terms of the motivation outside of rhetoric. So you can't argue with them. So the best you can do is diagnose them. So I don't think there's any one new speech, any one new commercial, any one new perspective that's necessary. That doesn't mean we shouldn't look for those. I absolutely think there are always possible, poetic and transcendent ways that might eventually take hold, that might eventually catch on and move some people. But by and large, we're kind of dug in here, and the words no longer make any difference. With abortion, at least you can kind of look at the religious doctrinaire nature of that. And I think with gun control, the Second Amendment really isn't the fount. The Second Amendment's the excuse.
Right.
It really does not fund this in the same way that the Ten Commandments funds, the abortion dictum. And there is this kind of inherent contradiction. Okay, we can't, doctors can't kill fetuses, but your next door neighbor kid can kill children up to the age, after the age of six. We're only as a society going to protect you for 6 years.
Right.
So anyway.
Well, I mean, start with this. So what I usually do on these issues is try to go in and turn it into an ecology that I can see, so that you can split it apart. And I tend to create clusters. So, you can kind of locate the smaller conversations within the big, cluster conversation that's going on, or as I like to call it, the mosh pit of, persuasion that's happening. So if you look at like gun motives, like the motivation for people owning guns, and it's splintered across a few different clusters, but the first thing just seems to be people like guns. They just enjoy, there's something about the gun experience that people enjoy, and they look at it as sport or fun.
Well, I think, I think it's more than, the level of entertainment one gets, out of their iPod or something, though. I think that there's a pretty deeply embedded power fantasy that attaches.
Well, that's that too. Like, that's what I mean, I cluster it. So power is definitely one of the things people draw.
Think about all the imagery of shooting a weapon that you've been saturated in since a child. Raised in the 50s, we played Army, we played World War II. What we watched on TV was, 80% World War II. This was before children's programming. And with the Westerns and everything. So shooting a firearm is itself, pretty well is, embedded somehow as the ultimate in one's power. The test that's occurred to me in the last week is because they keep saying, well, this is not about guns. I mean, how many different ways can you say it's not about the gun? Well, why aren't these people using hand grenades? It just seems to be more efficient. And there's only two answers that occur to me. One is that they can't buy them, which only bolsters the gun control side of the argument, right?
Right.
They're not using hand grenades because...
Right. They can't get any.
Well, maybe we should consider the same prospect with AR-15s. Or there isn't the same kind of fantasy. There isn't the same kind of power that attaches itself to having, owning, and being able to fire the weapon. So I think one thing that rhetoric broadly considered can get at is... the imagery of killing and the culture behind this, which is really, the only possible answer to the question.
Yeah, clearly the storyism of guns has to be part of this. And you look at over the weekend, Maverick, the sequel to Top Gun, debuted as the biggest movie ever over Memorial Day. And it's like...
A fighter jet is itself a...
Yeah,
weapon, right?
It is a super weapon, just like the AR-15 is a super weapon, and the glorification of that and the masculinity of it and the heroism and all that, it has to be at least a factor. in the, it's like, how many anti-gun movies do we see?
Well, yeah, I mean, but I think that is also embedded. If you, and I don't know about everybody in the culture, but as a young male, I mean, who hasn't had the fantasy of defending one's, you know, from a child's age, defending one's family, defending one's house, I think that we're, the fantasy of needing a gun and wielding a gun is a pretty deeply embedded one in some sort of paranoid fantasy. And if you ask specifically about the paranoid fantasy of the assault rifle, this seems to be largely, militaristic, either to the government has become impressive and they're coming for you, or you're a Ukrainian and you're fighting, an invading right. army or something. So well, that kind of ultimate self-reliance
right.
and individuality is deeply woven.
Right. And I'm not jumping from story right over to, oh, ergo, but like first person shooter games and video games. My kid, my ex wouldn't let him do first person shooter games. And I'm like, okay, I get it. When you watch this, it's literally somebody with an automatic weapon just walking through the world, shooting whatever pops up.
Just even those with a Glock, just pop, you're having a graphic experience, almost a virtual reality of blowing somebody in his head off.
Yeah, that is exactly what you get in shooter games.
That's what you're doing. And that's a big dopamine rush. It truly is.
Yeah, and so again, I don't jump from that to ergo people are going out to shoot things up, but it is certainly creating grooves for potential lived stories, within the culture. And we don't have much countervailing, stories. There was a movie that came out last year, the year before, called New Guy, I think, with Ryan Reynolds. And it was basically one of the players that gets killed in the games all the time. Came to consciousness and started becoming part of, instead of just being there to be shot, he started his own storyline. Of course, his storyline was to then go out and shoot everybody else. But it was this awareness that, within that story structure, there are other stories going on. And like the victim story right now is so dominant. Like when this something like this happens and the victims are young kids and it's so, such an ugly scene, the victim story comes up and takes over for a while. But then it seems like once that fades a little bit in people's memory, then the shooter story and the, like you said, the narrative, the heroic narrative of the guns, comes back into prominence.
All right, I suppose we could kind of look at, the better than gun fantasy, like The Matrix, or I was thinking of Deadpool when you mentioned Ryan Reynolds, right? Mm-hmm. In a way, that is his character there, that he's invulnerable, so he chooses better than gun kinds of ways of because they can, they can do some. They're immune to the gun power in some fantasy.
Well, they always are, right? They're either the bullets bounce off, or like he's an interesting character.
Well, yeah, from Superman on, right? The TV show, the bullets bouncing off of him, he takes the gun and squeezes it in his hand. Sure.
Well, I remember the big scene in one of the more recent Star Wars when all the power of the Empire was shot at Obi-Wan Kenobi, or maybe it was Luke Skywalker, and none of them could hurt him because he was the perfect hero. He had transcended. He was zen enough that you could not, hurt him anymore.
Bullets cannot harm me.
So you get into this narrative structure, and I think it's a useful way of thinking about this because it does explain it in some ways that once the gun owner becomes the hero in the story, like you said, the defender, the military, all these different things, it's really hard to go into that story and then villainize the guns.
Right. And it's just the absolutism of it. Why the particular assault weapon? If I got the story correctly, and they changed so many aspects of the Texas story in the last.
And the only thing was worse than the police department was their PR.
I guess. Geez, it all smelled of some massive cover-up of something, but
clumsiness.
But the one, at least what I understood was that in Texas law, the kid could not have bought a handgun, but it's only the long rifle, right? The long gun that. And Abbott's answer was, we can't change that because it's 60 years old. Well, I thought, well, that's not exactly the Old West. That's not exactly the Alamo. This is 1962. Anybody can buy a long rifle just in time to kill Kennedy. I don't, you know, this is not exactly a deeply embedded cultural. And the relationship between the AR-15 and the long gun, right? The hunting rifle is...
Yeah,
I mean that's the flimsiest kind of, you know, once again, that one's tempted to just argue with these things, but so that you know, once again, you can somehow compromise these things, but there is this sort of, you know, absolute barrier that simply will not yield to these kinds of things.
Do you really feel that way, or if you were able to bring to bear what you think and how you do things on one person, not trying to change, you know, see change across a mass of people, but don't you think you could get some inroads, you can get some traction and with someone if they would sit down and talk about guns?
Well, sure, but almost nothing happens as a result of one persuasive event. It's this, you know, there's some people that take the shape of, you know, like a pillow, whoever was the last one to sit on it. that same person will walk into a different room and be, you know, bolstered the other direction.
Surely they couldn't forget a session with Dave Payne, you know, uber rhetorician.
Well, I get, you know, one person at a time. Well, you know, I guess this is back to the larger political landscape here, which once again may be beyond rhetoric, if indeed the polls are accurate that anywhere between 70 and 90% of the people will accept some form of, you know, gun restrictions. Why politically you still can't get it done? What is that ultimate barrier? And that gets back to as many of these things with the ability of a very strident minority in the Senate to block everything.
Well, and the strident
as nearly as we can tell, that's it, you know.
And the strident minority maybe being an outgrowth, you know, a front for something else. I've seen a lot of this stuff recently about study. There was a study, was it in Stanford or Yale, about America's no longer a representative democracy. Like they literally showed over the last 30 years or so, like all the judicial decisions, all the legislative decisions, even the voting goes along the lines more of this is a corporate democracy. It's like the majority cannot get their will impressed into government anymore.
Well, I think that in greater or lesser degrees, that's been true for, you know, all 40 years or so, the majority of people have not agreed with conservative policies in general since the 70s. Conservatives have held Congress and the presidency more often. So, you know, part of that is rhetorical and part of that is mediated and all of the reasons we've been talking about. Fear.
Well, then if you go in it maybe from that angle, like gun control is its own thing, but it's also representative of a bigger issue about government. Sure. Right now. Maybe there's traction there.
I think so, and I think that is kind of probably the most effective rhetoric of the last week is the people saying, "Why can't government address this?" And I think that you know, because this stands so singularly, not that Sandy Hook wasn't, and on, but you know, the dissonance of having a room full of 10-year-olds mowed down with an AR-15 is sufficient. Mm-hmm. That it becomes incomprehensible that government cannot respond at all. So it's enough to expose all the holes.
Well, and even the limits within that rhetoric, right? Like you hear about that as an abstraction. There's a certain point where they don't show you the images. They don't really get into, they don't really allow the full technology, the media technology, to bring that experience to you. Like 60 Minutes ran a show the other night about, you know, what a regular 9mm bullet does to this block of gel versus an AR-15 bullet. And, you know, it just exploded this thing. It's the exponential damage. And then, like, think about what that did to kids. It's like, sure, you know, but that's still an abstraction. Everything else, you know, is brought to us in high def and repeated endlessly. I mean, is there a role for that? Or is that just once the point when you get that kind of graphic rhetoric, people can't, they can't handle it. And it just blows it all up.
And is it as powerful? I mean, I think that you know, that horror is easily accessed by people.
Still an abstraction.
And one of the stronger moves here is, go ahead, I'm sorry.
It's still an abstraction. You're sort of thinking about it and comparing it to other graphic images you've seen. I know, like in LA, and they do this everywhere, but I've seen a lot of it in LA. They have the trucks, the anti-abortion trucks that are driving around with massive billboards on both sides of incredibly graphic images of fetuses. And so, you know, they were like, that side definitely does not hold back on the grisliness of the rhetoric.
Yeah, that was, the picture of the aborted fetus is having taught public speaking classes in those years. I think I banned that particular visual aid just because it seemed to me to replace the skills I was trying to get them
about. Sure. And it does, but that's part of the thing, right? The other side has replaced a lot of these skills that you and I have learned and put forth into the world about civil discourse and really looking at the logic here and really thinking this through, and have replaced it with super story and super claim and all these.
Yeah, the one thing that people cannot get around in this one is the, if you're a parent, and the vulnerability, I mean, it is unthinkable. It is absolutely unthinkable so that to me has been the strongest thing that, you know, some parent leaving their child at school defenseless, you know, and then somebody like Ted Cruz saying, well, what we need is only one door, you know. That seems to me to be the heavier emotional argument.
Right. Well, and I think that sort of experiential, you know, based persuasion, like I tweeted yesterday, Reagan was shot and Reagan was a strong proponent of the Brady Bill.
Right. You know?
So let's pull this stuff back into, like, if we can't get there just with rhetorical talk, rhetorical experience, like rhetorically driven experience, can also do a lot. And if that's what we need to do to start going to those kind of techniques to get traction, then maybe that's the kind of stuff we need to start designing.
I think, you know, that's all there. And maybe this historical part, you know, there was at one point an assault weapons ban. We did manage to do this. Where have we gotten to that's not possible? Are the case of Australia's being offered of, you know, in 1996, they offered this buyback program with dramatic results. You know, once again, you're fighting you're fighting a system, you're fighting a deeply entrenched conservative identity group for which this is this victory is important, maybe even central. So it's going to be a tough one. Yeah.
Well, and I think that, again, when I look at the way rhetoric becomes more and more useful to people. So let's do that. Let's break apart. Who are the targets here? You know, who are the intractables, or who are the players that we need to persuade? You know, there are the people, like you said, like parents have there's a clear avenue into a deep psychology and emotionality to trigger in parents. Like, you can't sit there and think about that event. Like, literally, it's intolerable to think about, you know, which causes its own problems. But break apart the players, like the NRA, you know, I've done a load of research over the last week about the NRA and essentially grabbing on to the GOP rhetorical policy of never apologize, never back down, never give an inch. It makes no difference, never a cede. And in some ways, in a capitalist culture, I totally get it. Like, manufacturers and suppliers are soulless entities. They're just there to sell guns. They don't have a moral imperative to help you get rid of guns. If you want to get rid of those guns, then you have got to take the rhetorical reins and figure out how to do that, because they're not going to do it for you.
Right.
You know, and so when you look at that and like, okay, well, what do we do with the NRA? And you're starting to see, you know, the clowns and the jesters try to invade their events. There was a guy called, from The Good Liars. Have you seen that? There's two dudes who basically go around and do the Comedy Central thing of a fake reporter asking questions at the rallies or whatever. But they got a 2-minute space at the NRA event talking to Wayne LaPierre, whatever his name is, directly, and basically did, you know, faint praise. They praised him for his thoughts and prayers and how he's always ready to give those. And like, and he listed the top 10 shootings, like, your thoughts and prayers went here, and your thoughts and prayers went here. And man, you just have a lot of thoughts and prayers, and we really appreciate that. And he never broke frame with it. And it was, you know, watching the guy squirm up there was kind of interesting. But, you know, that's where you can start to target down and go, okay, well, maybe the whole issue is intractable. But if you pull out little star clusters and go after those rhetorically.
Yeah, start writing that up for Sacha Baron Cohen, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, perfect.
Sure.
You know, and ultimately, sure, maybe that's just a light graze across the bow to these people.
The one that comes to mind is Michael Moore with Charlton Heston, right? And the little girl that is just such a... You
know. Yeah, and there's lots of guys doing that now. There's lots of people that are trying to take that particular rhetorical entree in, and it's, you know, gets them inside the door, and they can do a little bit of lampooning, and then they're gone. And I'm saying that's the issue, that's the answer, but it does show that there are rhetorical options.
If you can get people to vote, right, that's what these people cling to, so that their $300,000 from the NRA come campaign time does not seem a winning formula.
Is that the best offer that we can make in a democracy right now?
We would hope. We would
just hope keep recruiting new people and getting them to vote. You know, is that the best rhetorical defense we've got to just keep?
Keeping the issue alive, and I think that seems to be the. It is one of those things that we want to do this forgetting. We want to return to normal, right? We want to hit the reset button psychologically after this is over. So this is why we only get a certain kind of psychological window after each one of these events, because, and that continues to sort of feed it, I guess, that we have this lineage of, you know, people who are willing to, for whatever pathological reason, you know, be the next. Notwithstanding the fact that at least I forget their names. None of these people are in the greatest, the annals of time for me, but.
Well, think about it again, narratively, there's no hero on the gun control side of the narrative, right? Who's the hero? Like, who's doing this? I mean, the Brady Bill at the time, you know, and then there was the woman who was
Beto O'Rourke for one shining moment.
Yeah, and the senator, Gabby, I can't remember her last name, Gabby Giffords, you know, these can become heroes because they've survived. They've been in this. And I've seen I've seen a lot of the kids that have survived, like, different shootings, there's a guy, kid David Hogg, trying to become the hero, you know, take on that mantle in a way to sort of galvanize the story around, you know, this. But there's no clear hero on the gun control side of this narrative.
Yeah, for a moment, you know, after the Parkland shootings in Florida, the high school students who got a lot of media time, and they actually got laws changed in Florida. I mean, I think that's another thing, is that these people are on a local level. It's the national drama that seems to be, but on a local level, they are getting responsiveness, and maybe that's the place to turn is You know, it seems ridiculous that you have to have one massive, horrific shooting in every state to get anywhere. But,
well, I think you mentioned this to me once back when Austin had its airport, you know, in your backyard. It's like, how are we going to move this? Well, as soon as there's a, you know, major crash in inside the suburbs, then they'll move the airport. Like, it's typically big tragedy that causes big change, but nationally, you know, on a full nation level.
I'm not saying it is hopeless. I do, but we have lived with this for a long time. And once again, it seems to come into view and go out and fade away, come into view and fade away. Maybe it is just this giant kind of rhetorical lint ball that will eventually accumulate enough and as you look at it, the things lined up on the other side there, you know, there's a lot of money tied up in this for someone. And then a lot of, you know, of the other things, you know, if we look at the militia movement, we look at militarism, if we look at the fantasies of crime that are constantly being fueled. I mean, and these are rhetorical entities that pay somebody.
Right. Yeah. They all have a bullhorn.
They all have a sponsor somewhere. Right.
And again, going back narratively, like if you look at the barbarism of America from its very beginnings, you know, we whitewash and whitewash and whitewash. But like somebody was saying to me, this was founded as a Christian nation. I'm like, yeah, a Christian nation of thieves, murderers, genociders. You know, they may have been Christians. That didn't stop them from doing any of these things. You know, so.
Well, you know, the old joke that they sent the Puritans here and they sent the criminals to Australia. But Australia has effective gun control legislation.
Yeah, I mean, it's. When you look at all
the Puritans, you can't disarm here.
So I agree. Like there is the kind of religion thing, and there's the freedom thing, that you know, the individual rights arguments, right? And somehow the fact that the founding fathers stuck guns in the Constitution, you know, that has become like one of the reasons why it is so intractable, because that document is so difficult to change, right? To get people,
well,
to
you know, and once again, that with all of the Supreme Court around the abortion issue, we have to look at the original, the concern. Well, what were the original paranoid fantasies that made that the Second Amendment? You know, first of all, the revolution, right? That the oppressive government, that you have a right to defend yourself, to raise a militia. But then we've also heard the argument that the militias at that time in the southern states, which were the ones that had a lot of objections to joining the Union, that the militia were armed groups to defend against runaway slaves. And you were in that system, the paranoid fantasy of needing guns to deal with slave uprisings was very real. I mean, you don't hold people in bondage without some edge here, right?
Yeah, somebody gets...
I think if we were able to dissect what were they protecting against, and there was no one thing that's gone on here is the vision of a civil society has undergone evolution, and I think since 1980 de-evolution, so that kind of Roosevelt era, you know, the Deweyan era from the early 1900s to the end of that, which I would mark with the election of Ronald Reagan, is the kind of the slow undoing since then.
So you think it was just because, and I talk about this a lot, that I think democracy got sort of lazy and flabby. It wasn't used to being attacked like this from the inside. It didn't see all the hackable vulnerabilities in the democracy code. And you had, you know, these kind of smart nefarians like the Karl Roves and the David Atwaters and all these people, or whatever his name, Atwater, all these people who looked at it and it's like, you know what, if we just do this, they have no defense against it. And that's what good nefarian sources do. They find the vulnerabilities and they use whatever weaponry that is available, regardless of its ethicality. It's like, no, we're going to do this and make them deal.
Right. Well, we've talked about this before, how part of the game board here is that those on the liberal civic side of these arguments don't really want to be vigilantly political. That's not their identity. They want laws to take care of these things so that they can trust to send their child to school. They can, right? They do live in a village where other people are looking out for you and your welfare, and they can take all of that for granted. So that vision is easy to undermine. And that's why one kid with an AR-15 can blow apart, an entire community, because the community, wants to operate on the basis that is, unthinkable. That's not, our institutions, our moralities are going to take care of that. So, I guess that to that extent, that is why it is terrorism. It relies upon terror as its vehicle. And it flies in the face of ordered society. So basically, the left here or even anything close to liberal society doesn't want to be political by and large. That the political drama is not what they want to engage in. So once again, it's only when something needs to be done and it gets plenty of, there is a rhetorical function, which is to maintain the status quo.
Well, and it's this idea of we've lived so long in a barely contested arena. Like the right and the extreme right, the white supremacist right, all this has been around for a long time, the militia right, but it's not really been a viable opponent. It has suddenly become a very viable opponent, and this idea of, yeah, I want to live in a, like I said, a flabby democracy where I don't have to think about it much. It's not a constant contest to stay free and to keep people safe. I don't want to fight all the time. It's like, well, it looks like you're going to have to, and maybe that's the big rhetorical move that Americans need to get over to, is like, oh, I guess we can't live in this comfort democracy anymore because it's not available.
Right. I think so. And I think maybe if we were able to, do time travel, we would find that prior to the 20th century, people didn't have the luxury that there was a sort of constant vigilance. And you did have to develop the moral substance that if it's going to be this way, you have to enact it. But with the massification of society and really the success. And I guess there is in that kind of perverted sense in which these people claim to be some sort of a minority that's oppressed, that there's that truth, that in a way they are reacting to kind of the success of, the growth of social institutions. And what it takes to succeed in society and be somebody in society, and they're frustrated and feel like they should be more. So,
well, in some ways, there is a play here, and you start to see it with some of the right wing stuff that I've watched, where somebody can screed well, like a good screeder, who can get on and talk for 4 or 5 minutes of a monologue, and you do get the sense of, ultimately, it's guns versus liberalism, right? That is part of the offer here. It's that guns are this sort of individual freedom. We can be a minority and still have power if we are well regulated and armed as a militia.
I do think that's right. And that kind of came forward in the Buffalo shooting, right? More that the organization and ideology behind all of this. No, I think that's probably right, is this sense of which managed to say that liberalism is itself the enemy that's destroying freedom, destroying democracy.
This paranoia of the minority, which minorities...
Is an insurrection if you think you're saving the Constitution?
Well, there's always got to be a good moral purpose for your insurrection, right? You can't just be, we are the shills of capitalism and, want to...
Make it's right there, the declaration, when government grows oppressive, we have the right to take arms. So,
yeah, and I watched a guy talk yesterday and he was basically saying, I don't want to hear about England and Britain and all these other countries that don't have guns. We're the first domino. That's the only reason that you're still free of your government is because we are holding the wall against our government with our guns.
And I think that is a sincere,
Yeah, the twisting of the logic that can still allow people to stay in the argument, you know, it's just a snake nest, or as I sometimes call it, a squid nest. Like, it's just legs and arms. You're like, what? Where are we? But they seem to have enough logic trails in there that people will walk no matter what.
Well, I did come up with one rhetorical salvo that I offer free to any politician who wants to use it, which is, I'm not coming for your guns. I'm coming for his guns.
His guns, meaning who?
The shooters, yes. The 18-year-old psychopath who's buying two AR-15s 3 days apart with God knows where he got the $4,000 required to make that purchase. This by itself should be a red flag, right?
Yeah. Did you see, I mean, it was through Daniel Defense is the name of the company that sold him those guns, and it was all in finance. He didn't need the money. So they've got a big financing program for these
3 years to pay. That's got to be really profitable for them since these people all die in 2 weeks.
Yeah. I don't know what
maybe they should review that policy.
So I've been writing jokes all week. My goal was to write, 300 jokes or so, joke solutions and problematic statements about guns, and see if any of those become useful. And one of the ones that I was saying was that, actuaries tell you, they won't even let you rent a car until you're 25.
That's right.
Actuarial science says you're a risk. You know, this isn't politicians or anything else. This is clear, just numbers. Under 25, you cannot responsibly drive a car, that we want to rent to you. So maybe
the fellow on Pod Save America said, you can't buy two cartons of two packs of Sudafed 3 days apart.
Right.
We have that restricted. We can keep you from doing that.
Well, also thinking maybe we ought to just outsource our politics, like let New Zealand create our laws. Like, we clearly can't do it ourselves. Like, this democracy is locked. You can't get anything done here. So we should just outsource it to a functioning democracy. You're just watching Canada and Trudeau just go, oh yeah, we're going to do this, 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 and this. And you're like, what? Governments can do that?
Right.
That's pretty amazing.
It is. Well, I think, yeah, guess government. That might be on.
Well, we've got to do things to expand our conception of this process, right? So this is locked, and I keep trying to show everybody, well, it's because democracy 1.0 doesn't really function in this kind of culture. You need a democracy 2.0, I think, where you do something like an ethical persuasion rule or something to control the ecology a little bit so that the nefarians don't have free access to all the standard, institutions of power and discourse, because they're just getting in there and just mucking it all up.
Right. I guess, if we start peeling this back, it seems to always wind up with, maybe we do want a representative democracy that the handful of people of Western North Dakota have a senator, and all the people living in San Francisco and Los Angeles have a senator. That maybe there is no possibility of majority rule, given the rules of the Senate at this point in time.
Yeah. So how do we pull back to that level, that 60,000 foot historical American level, and go, guess what? We need to do a new Continental Congress and reset this Constitution.
Yeah. Where did you get the idea of the filibuster anyway? Where did this come from? This idea that, One Kentucky senator can block in, us from solving a problem.
What's that elitism, that the oligarchical elite will all agree on something because they're smart and they know what's right and all that kind of stuff?
I suppose that is a patriarchal, class-based artifact, sure.
But it is the only one that has no checks and balances to it, right? Like, You can't even override. You can't override the Senate, can you?
Well, they could change the rules so that 51%, right?
But the Senate has,
and I don't know that that would be such a blow against democracy, if at all, because you still have to have the president and you still have to have the House to get anything done. Maybe, you know, I'm just, this is like the fourth or fifth issue we've come up against where to have meaningful, you know, change capable of preserving, you know, the democracy itself, as well as good sense, is going to require that, you know, we get rid of the filibuster so that 51%. And of course, I suppose the counter argument is, well, and next year when the Republicans have 51%.
Right. Yeah. And so, well, then if our target becomes the oligarchical, you know, communes of power, like how do you persuade somebody like Mitch McConnell? You know, I also tweeted today about making this personal, you know, maybe ask him directly, hey, you've been in the Senate for 40 years. What have you done directly, you, to make schools safer for kids not being shot? Like just list all the things that you've done and tried to do and all your goods, you know, and if you can, of course, they're always dodging and darting away, but if you can personalize this, maybe that gets some kind of traction. Is there still a humanity play with the oligarchy?
Going to the voters of Kentucky saying, what's really going on here, guys? Right? Let's look at your two senators.
That's not going to do anything. Kentucky's not going to.
That's not going to happen, huh?
No.
Well, but how can we, I mean, from the outside, how can you, you know, why does Mitch McConnell keep getting returned? Maybe we can formulate this as some sort of rhetorical maxim and see what the exceptions to it are. I don't know of anybody who is willingly gives up power.
Right. That's the issue, right? Like the NRA.
Nobody's just going to give up power.
No matter how moral your appeal is, like no moral appeal will get the power havers to go, okay.
Well, because there is a moral precept here, which is it's better off the power be in my hands than somebody else's. I mean, this is an axiomatic conceit, right? I would think the exceptions to this are very few indeed. So somehow that means, in order for that to happen, right, the way that we, you know, somebody's got to seize that power.
Well, what did you think about the Beto O'Rourke thing of him walking into the theater? You know, and he's
my first response was, I think Beto ought to take out a series of billboards across Texas and say, elect the sick son of a bitch, you know, who wants to save your children, right? It's smaller parens here. Right, that's what the guy called him from the podium. Was, you sick son of a bitch, right?
That was a beautiful, I mean, talk about, you know, story moment. You get these old Texas, you know, guy on crutches yelling with his big handlebar mustache, you're out of line. And right. You got one guy respectfully walking up and saying, I don't think you're doing anything here. And it's a young white guy. So let's play narrative here. Let's play traditional leadership, you know, narrative structure in America. You know, they instantly were like, oh, he's JFK. I'm like, you know, I get it that he fits the slot, but I'm not sure he fits it, you know, that well.
Right. Well, you know, once again, I mean, we disarm and disavow these people by instant character, you know, assassination. And, oh, he was politicizing this horrible tragedy. Oh, you know, he was doing this for personal gain. Once again, I did like the response of the pod Save America boys say, well, wait a minute, that assumes that this was a very politically astute thing to do in the state of Texas. There's no real evidence of that Beto O'Rourke was really doing a rather sincere and humane thing, and it's outrage about this. But you'll never get the other side to see it that way. That he's just too easy to discount.
Yes, and there are lots of discounts like that. To me, the GOP is the party of discount and discredit, and they're very good at it, you know. But again, that's the idea of making people more rhetorically sophisticated So they don't allow those discredits instantly, and your side can, you know, come back against that discrediting. I've seen some of that too. It's like, oh, you don't think it was political theater with Abbott on stage with all these, you know, Texas Rangers behind him with hats talking about the event? That didn't look like political theater.
Right. And it's a separate conversation for more, you know, academic laboratory contemplation. But it you know, it feeds into what I would call the rhetoric of character, that we are weighing these decisions, we are weighing these positions, we are weighing, you know, all embedded in an individual person. You know, the whole debate about who the character of the president, whether it's Trump or Biden or whatever, is completely erroneous, right? I mean, whether it's the moral character or just the empowered character, whether, you know, how they swagger or whatever it is, this is the way we're reading all the signs of leadership. And this is about Beto and Abbott rather than about, you know, the issue that is at struggle here. And so it wants reducing that. And that's, it's only in that world that you can elect a Trump anyway, right?
Right.
You know, despite the evidence that he did basically nothing for the people that elected him, as far as I can tell, nothing successfully, with no knowledge of government, continually surprised by every new wrinkle, right? Had to have a team of people sort of keep him propped up and out of the Oval Office as much as in. So, you know, but once again, his character is the answer to this. It has all embodied an individual character. And I think once again, that's just the mythos of America.
Anyway. Well, that's Maverick, right? Again, go back to, hey, this guy's been off TV since, you know, out of
redeeming, the redeeming your dad's problems is really what makes you a great pilot.
Top Gun, which was a system, you know, now it's just the dude, just Maverick. And everybody knows what that means. And he's back to do some good for the good for America.
Did you actually go to this movie?
I haven't seen it yet. I will at some point. You know, it's got interesting rhetoric written.
It's got the things, yeah, okay.
But it's the sense, and I see, like, you know, I'm always trying to get back to, I have this ladder system of mega down to pico messaging. So here's the mega level and down to macro, and I created mid-cro because you need something in the middle there, and macro down to pico. And like when you go down to techniques and tactics to try to get some kind of efficacy here, so you empower people to think of themselves as rhetoricians, even if it's informal baby amateur rhetoricians, like how do I talk to my crazy, you know, grandfather about guns? Well, let's just maybe localize it down all the way down to the nano level or the micro level of what kind of gun. You know, if we can do some lexicon separation between, like you said earlier, the long rifle and the AR-15, like those have gotten somehow in the same.
That really shouldn't be too difficult. And I think that's it. I mean, somebody should be rhetorically able to hear that and go, wait a minute. Right. I mean, that's an erroneous identification.
But those are the small wins that maybe you can make. And you say, do you think the rifles that you've got in this house are the same as an AR-15? And if you get those logical steps, you know, rungs in the ladder, you can start to move a little bit.
Well, you know, it's a military weapon. It was invented to kill people in mass quantities. That's its only function. I mean, everybody's made those kinds of moves. And how easily they are short-circuited by saying, oh, well, it's a long gun, which is, you know, rhetorically you have to say that's a lie. This is about the militia-minded thinking that living in some sort of paranoid world where they're going to be, you know, saving themselves, saving something, vanquishing evil somehow. You know, for you know, back to the Kenosha, you know, somebody to hand that child one of these weapons. That to me is the criminal act there.
Right. Well, you got the other players then, right? You got the parents. Like, what's the role of the parent here to report this kid if they think they're dangerous? Surely that 18-year-old didn't just one day become, you know, this dangerous entity. You know, what are the other players like? So go back to hero, villain, victim, and stakeholder or bystander. And when we start moving around and we can do some rhetorical control of the chessboard, what does that look like? You know, Herschel Walker came up and mishmouth this week about maybe we need a, you know, a national institute that looks at what young kids, boys are looking at online. Like, well, sure, I get that logic. That's looking around for logical things about, you know, this particular role, which is to evaluate kids for danger, you know, which is a diagnostic role.
Or more school counselors, right? More BAs in psychology talking about self-esteem is going to, it does bespeak a weakness in our society that these people are not monitored at all, basically, right? There is nobody's keeping an eye on folks, which is, and we do have the technologies, right? You're 18.
Oh, yeah.
You purchase a semi-automatic weapon. That should by itself be a red flag worthy of investigation. But the second one, come on, our 400 rounds of ammo, come on. If you can't rent a car at that age, there's no reason why you should be able to purchase a weapon of war. So
maybe that's,
you know, and the answer is these are just logical basics,
right?
But back to the rhetorical protections of the individual unit. If somebody argues to you that there is nothing we can do about a system where someone can get an automatic weapon, semi-automatic weapon, and walk into a classroom and kill 20 children, one should listen no farther, right?
Those are exactly the people that you've got to do some rhetorical work on. I always make the argument about leaving those people alone. They still get to vote. You know, those are the people we have to figure out. If we are doing sophisticated rhetoric, how do you get into those brains, into those psyches?
What I'm saying. I'm saying that really, I mean, you know, there should be no amount of counter argument or analogy or positions that circumvent that clear moral good. That no, we as a society should be able to do something about this. And we know that school counseling, we know that mental health attentions, whatever, are not going to be that. And of course, I guess on the other side, they're saying, oh, there's nothing we could have done that would have stopped this from happening. I think that's just baloney.
Yeah, it's surface level dismissive thinking, which is very common in America. I run into it all the time when I talk to the right. They haven't thought down below the surface statements. It's all claim. It's not evidence or introspection or any of those other processing structures.
So this is rhetorical argument, especially in the media, especially at the shallow level. If I can offset every argument with another argument, then somebody has to go to some sort of effort to budge. And basically people will err on the side of the path of least resistance, lack of change, whatever's convenient for them, or forgetting or ignoring, or like the cognitive dissonance model, simply downplaying the importance of this, the item that is causing the dissonance, okay? So to sort of say, gee, there's nothing we could have done legally to, you know, none of the things, this is Ted Cruz's direct quote, none of the things the Democrats are proposing would have changed this event. And even if that were true, which it is not in this one case, how about the other 690 examples of the last year, right? It's obviously a canard, but it is sufficient to cause people to penetrate no further. Because once again, if to do the kind of counter argument, all you have to do is pull even to actually get the warrant for changing, right? Going to the polls, making the vote, holding your representatives responsible, winning the Senate, whatever, pushing it past the goal line. So once again, that the default goes to the one side. That all you have to do is neutralize at the most basic level.
Right.
With a counter argument.
Right. But until they keep coming into our herd and culling our people and getting them to think over into the other side, at some point your numbers don't protect you. And that's kind of what's happened, right? When you look at the 74 million or that voted for Trump, you're like, good Lord, how are there that many people that will fall for this rhetoric?
I have to think maybe we have to unformulate that. They didn't necessarily fall for that rhetoric. What the anti-Biden rhetoric was sufficient to get them to, right, go with the status quo. This, as an example, what I was just talking about.
Well, that's part of it, though, right? The, like I said, I look at this stuff and the ethical, unethical divide simply because discrediting the opponent to the point where you will just vote for anybody else is not an ethical technique. It's an effective technique, but it's not ethical. I'm watching all the ads right now in California for all the primaries when I was at the gym this morning. It's just slander. I mean, it's outright slander. Like, how can you have like a slander law in the real world and then no slander law at all in the political world? Like, how can you say these things straight out? Like, oh, this guy is going to come in and shoot your entire family. I can see it in his face. Look at him. You know, it's, what do you do to restrict?
It's back to character and good versus evil. I mean, this.
But we've got to, as rhetoricians, we've got to have something stronger than.
Got something better than a beer can opener to perform surgery.
I look at the character rhetoric, you know, with this stuff, and again, I like narrative approaches to this because I think it's a really strong play in the digital world, much stronger than argument. Moving over to either emotion or especially story right away, I think is a much better way of doing this. So, and if you like, we keep trying to turn Cruz into one of our major villains. He's clearly one of the left's major villains. And it's because he's so clumsy. He's so bad with the techniques, but he's always out front. He's the guy that's willing to get out there and just say the party line and sound stupid, you know? And that's why it's so easy for the left to go after him as a left villain. But sure. Why isn't he a right villain? What do we do to turn him into a villain for the right?
Well, I think that's a pretty good question. How is one? Can one catch them doing anything? Actually, the hiking off to Cancun was kind of just a nice little gotcha.
But you saw, like, Trump flirted with becoming a villain to the right with the vaccine. When he finally said, "No, you should take the vaccine," I took it, and they were all like, "Hold on." And they all try to turn on him for a little bit. Then he just stopped talking about it. But that's one of the evils, you know, one of the villainous things for their side. Is that what we need to do is catch?
Sure. And once again, I think it just exposes the fallacy of making it all about Trump. I mean, Trump is people are capable of sustaining far more abstraction than that. They realize that he's a placeholder for something else. And so the 10 million people more that voted for Trump the second time than the first time are not necessarily endorsing Trump, are not necessarily immune to all the goofy things he did. They're simply involved in some larger political drama, of which the vilification of Joe Biden, but really largely the Democrats and progressivism in general, is the drama. If we just make it all about Trump or all about Biden or whatever, that's kind of you got to keep doing that. It's sort of like as a branding exercise, I suppose. But it really, I don't think is what makes people act one way or another.
So you would go after the thought system then behind it, like the idea that, you know, that the right has gone after socialism and liberalism and Democrats as a seething, invisible, conspiratorial evil that is trying to destroy America. And whoever pops up to the top of it, they've got the same attacks. It doesn't matter who it is.
Absolutely. And people are willing to ignore, you know, how much do you have to ignore to cast Trump in the role of a religious savior? I mean, come on. That requires no small amount of right, fudging.
Look at all you had to ignore to cast Jesus as a religious savior for white America, you know, this Middle Eastern brown guy.
Ignore the fact that he's a Middle Eastern brown guy is kind of central there.
But they just lose it. They're just like, he's a white guy. You know,
if you think that people reason backwards, not from the abstraction of who was Jesus as an embodied historical figure, but all that I believe to be good, which is America, capitalism, and, you know, middle of Illinois, whatever it happens to be, gets superimposed as on top of the Jesus figure. So we draw a Jesus figure who basically is a caricature of those things. You know, sure. the guy with the long wavy brown hair, the blue eyes, the guiding the ship.
Yeah, and we do the same thing with Trump, right? Like we want we draw the caricature and print on him no matter what he does. It makes no difference.
And you know, and rhetorically, what's happening in the pulpits of all of these country churches across the country is a far more powerful rhetorical experience than what's on MSNBC every night. So, you got to take the battle to where it's being fought.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And I think that's sort of always my thing about...
That is your mission. That is your mission.
Perseverating with these techniques that have driven you through civic democracy forever and realize the playing field has changed. You don't have to go to unethical techniques, but you have to play those games. If they want to play story games, you have to play a story game. If they want to play image games, you have to play image games, because they're getting inroads and you're not even meeting them on the road. You're just letting the forces just come on into Kiev, whatever it is, how you say it in Ukraine, with no opposition. Like the GOP's Russian forces are just streaming into the rhetorical arena. You're like, what are we going to do? It's like, well, maybe you ought to mount a counter defense here.
Arm everyone with these rhetorical techniques.
Exactly. And then we'll be in the arena together. And
at least we talked a little bit about body armor.
Yeah. So again, like there's so much in this, and I'm interested in sort of excavating and filling as much of this area with good rhetorical structures as possible. So we'll see. I'm sure.
It is like many of these issues that we've talked about. It is a 40 to 50 year long struggle, and deeply interwoven with these other political forces, I think.
I'll do some research. Surely some people have done some real work on the rhetoric of gun control.
Sure.
There's going to be some rhetoricians that have focused on this across time, I would think. So I'm going to do some of that research. Well, I appreciate you jumping on again. As always, I drag you into stuff that I've been thinking about a lot, and I appreciate you jumping in and just, you know, giving your thoughts.
Doing what I can.
Yep. So enjoy Florida down there. You know, things are always safe in Florida. God knows what the reaction is going to be to all this in Florida, but
that's an interesting I haven't seen any. I think I did hear a voiceover of Marco Rubio embracing the status quo, but other than that I haven't heard much.
Embrace the status quo. Just a big hug for the status quo. Well, enjoyed it, David. Thanks for popping on. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there and persuade some people, even on intractable issues, because we need you to do that work.